Okay, today's December 16th. We are in Amos, Perek Vav. We're up to Pasuk Tet. And we are seeing how bad it's going to get in the northern kingdom. That if 10 people are huddled together in one house, you can picture it like the there are images that we know from the Holocaust, where they would put four or five families in one little burnt out house in the ghetto, you know, with no plumbing, of course. And these are, you know, 20 people, and it's smaller, much, much smaller than this. If you have a grandparent who remembers such a thing. And then, that's in the ghetto. What they were going to have when the ghetto is liquidated is much worse. So he speaks about people huddled together to try to survive. And look what they're experiencing. Unisa'o dodo. Dodo can be his uncle or his friend. Nisao is this survivor of whoever else is constantly dying in this house. Umisorfo. Umisorfo. There is no Hebrew word in the Bible, samach resh pei. But the Targum may give us a hint to what this word means. Because look at the Targum. It says, Biyitlene, that's Unisao. Unitalasni rucha yisei batisaini ruach. Right, al netilas yadayim comes from this word. We're lifting up the hands. So un nisao, vitzline, dodo. Here in English, in the Arabic reads krive. So there, dodo means his relative, probably maybe his uncle. All right, look at the next word, mikeda, or mokeda. I said mokade in Aramaic. Code. It's a Hebrew word also in the Tanakh. Code is to burn. Right? So the Targum is rendering this word as if though it's not Samach Resh Pei, but Sid Resh Pei, which is a kind of Hebrew word, to burn. What are they burning? Take a look. Unisao dodo umisorfo lahotzia tzamin min habayis. The burner comes into the house, the Omar La Asher Biyakasei Abayis, Ha'odimach? Anyone else in there? The Omar office. He says, no, there's no more here. The Omar Haski Lola Haskir B'Shem Hashem. And they'll say, quiet. Quiet. This is not the time to mention God. What a strange pasuk, very long pasuk. But this is how Radak renders this pasuk. Right? Radak says that there was so much disease, so much death everywhere. The people were dying just in the house. There's no hospitals, no doctors, there's nothing. It just when someone dies, what are you going to do with him? The dead body is spreading more disease. They did this during plagues. What would the people would come from house to house? You ever see this? They went with wagons in the Kovna ghetto, in the Warsaw ghetto. They would go with wagons every day in front of these awful, dilapidated residences for thousands and thousands of people. And they would force the bodies onto the wagons every day for burning. See, just this is in the ghetto. This is not in the camps. I'm talking in the ghettos. Right? Almost is referring to just such a thing. The misorfo was the burner who would come up to each house with the wagon to say, toss out the bodies for burning. We have to burn these bodies. They're decomposed and they're spreading more and more disease. Okay, that's the fact of the resha of the pasuk. That's what's going on, and we have reference to it. They did this during the bubonic death, the black plagues. This is what they did every day, right? And we have pictures of this, actual pictures from the ghetto. What is the end of the pasuk saying? Right. But just backtrack to the beginning again. There is precedent for this. For in Shmuel, the end of Shmuel Aleph, when it says that the Philistines captured Shaul and his three sons. Remember what they did to them? They hung them up in the town square. They were dead already. This is why Shaul wanted to kill himself. Because what do you think they're going to do to him if they capture him alive? Right? They caught him dead and they stripped them. And they paraded them naked through the town and then hung them up in the town square in Beit Sha'an. So, and they stood there for who knows how long. Right? Until people from a place called Yavesh Gilad one knight came and very heroically removed the bodies, took them all the way down to Yerushalayim to bury them there. What today is called Givat Shaul, right? Right near the central bus station. So the here's the thing though. In Sefer Shmuel, it says that before burying them, they burnt them. It says they burnt the bodies, and then they buried the bones. So the Radak, there like here, discusses what is it? What does this mean? It says that, look, a few times have been involved with people who have gone missing, or they didn't show up to work. The whole weekend they didn't show up, and they had to go into the apartment and see what happened to them. They fell, they hit their head, and then 2 or 3 days later, if it's hot, I don't even want to begin to, you can imagine what starts to happen on that floor where they fell. Just 2 or 3 days, if it's July and the windows are all closed, well, the reason why they started to call is because neighbors smelled something awful, and we had to bring the police up, and it's awful. Every time I did, the parents were with me. It was young people who just fell or something. Or, right? Anyway, the point is that Radak says that the bodies of Shaul and his three sons are decomposed to such a level that we couldn't even put them in a sack. We couldn't do anything. We just had to burn whatever was left. We took the bodies off the wall and took the bones down to bury. That's the Radak. Right? Then the Radak mentions a second opinion that says they didn't burn the bodies. They made a burning for the bodies. You ever hear of this? In the ancient world, they used to make, when a king, especially a king, died, they would make a bonfire of some of his very personal effects. Things that no one should use, not even his son. Right? So they would burn his saddle. They would burn certain, what would be today, your shaver, something that no one else should use. I don't know, things that you, very personal objects. They would make a burning of all those things. All right? So that's how Radak says that. It doesn't say they burned them. It really means they made a burning for them. Why would anyone say such a thing? It says they burnt them. I'll tell you why. Because in Divrei Hayamim, if you all know what Divrei Hayamim is, right? Right? Divrei Hayamim is like a review of the kings. So it starts with Shmuel. Actually, the Divrei Hayamim part that starts the history begins with the death of Shaul, chapter 1:10 of Divrei Hayamim Aleph. And then most of it is about David and Shlomo and then the other kings. Right? So it describes the burial of Shaul. It says they took down the bodies, made a burning for them because they were kings and princes, and then they buried them in Givat Shaul. So Divrei Hayamim is a pasuk in Tanakh that tells us this is what Shmuel meant when he said they burnt them. But here, we're not really given to such an interpretation. Here it's very obvious what this person is doing. He's burning the decomposed bodies. Right? Okay, enough on the ration. Now on the sefer. What does it mean, has, chilola haskir v'shem Hashem? How's it? Silence. Has means be silent. Chilola haskir v'shem Hashem. The Radak gives two perushim. Has, chilola haskir v'shem Hashem. Not time to mention God's name. Right? So there are two directions that the Mepharshim go on this, and this is what it is. Okay. Right. One is that it's typical. You guys never mentioned God's name when things were going well. That's when you forgot God. Now that we're burning decomposed bodies, now you want to mention God? Get it? Hus! Silence! This is not the time to mention God. Yilola is here for shame Hashem. I actually, I'm old enough to remember in my, I'm so old, but I remember someone who, in my shul, who was actually taken to Dachau after he was married already. He's a young man, he was married in 1937, passed away over 100 years old, and he was telling me about his time in Dachau. I wouldn't call it a death camp. It was certainly a concentration camp, but thousands of people died there, of course, and they continued to function during the war as well. But it was one of the first places where they were taking Germans before the war, if they didn't like what you were doing, or they felt you were too political. So he said that in Dachau, amazingly, the Jews also broke off into groups. They had the Reform Jews. Yeah, they weren't like all united to try to get through this situation. And he said that there were these meetings of Reform Jews that were discussing philosophical issues. Why is God doing this to us? He didn't quote this passage to me, but it fits. He says, now they're talking about God. Right? God wasn't part of their CV at any other time, and now that we're in Dachau, now it's time to have a philosophy about why God is leaving us and is allowing such of course, the much worse was yet to come. But this is what the way Radak understands is Has ki lo lahazkir b'shem Hashem. This is not the time to philosophize. This is actually. So the other direction that Radak takes it is that it's not the time to philosophize, even if you always mention Shem Hashem. The thing to do now is to survive. You know what I'm saying? Right? It doesn't mean divorce God from your from this whole discussion. No. But this is not the time to sit and you know, it's Eitz Lasos Lashem, Hefer Torah Secha. It means that it's a time to, you have to concentrate your efforts on surviving this. Right? You follow what I'm saying? Sort of like Avraham, the three men in the background, and he says, God, this is not the time for me to talk to you. I got to take care of these guys. They look hungry. Right? So that's what he was saying here, is Haski lo lazkir b'shem Hashem. You've got to concentrate your efforts, because survival is in English, to decimate a place is to kill 1 in 10. 90% survive in a place that is decimated. One-tenth. Amos said earlier, 9 in 10 won't survive. What's that called? Right? Some countries, 9 out of 10 Jews didn't make it out of the war. Right? Yes.
Could it also mean that the house looked to Hashem? Didn't in different Nevi'im, they blamed God. They said, well, we were doing our Avodah Zarah so good, now when we started to do the Shabbat, we're being exiled and being oppressed by... Yeah. So couldn't that mean that as well?
It's a worthy comment. There are some prophets who spoke with that kind of a chutzpah right now. Habakkuk, read the first verse in the Habakkuk, it's Tresor. So take a look for this minute. Just look further in, if you have it, and it's all in one volume, if you have volume. Right, just look at the first few psukim in Sefer Chabakuk. Hamaso asher chozo Chabakuk hanavi. See, turn. Tefenachum. It's short. You might miss it. Okay. Micha nachum Chabakuk. Ad ona Hashem shivati velo tishma. It's right to business. How long do I have to cry out to you, God, and you're not listening? Ezak elecha chamas velo toshia. I call out about all the violence done to us, and you don't save us. Lama tariri oven ve'amol tavit. We find out later he's not talking about the violence that's committed by Jews, he's talking about the violence committed by the enemies of the Jews. Right? Why do I have to keep looking at all this iniquity, all this strife that is committed against us, and all the violence? That Yirivu Madom Yisa. And that we should bear the burdens of all of this strife. Al Kein Tafu Torah. That's why your Torah is weak. V'lo Yitzei LaNetzach Mishpat. That's why there's no justice. Who cares about justice right now? We just care about survival. The wicked crown the tzaddik. Meaning the crowning, mean like they get the best of the tzaddik all the time. That's why your people aren't interested in justice. Who's interested in justice right now? Right? This is an element that you know, Chaim complains about. The rest of his book, he tries to, you know, fix this. Right? One, you've heard of a sefer called Mimamakim, right? It's one of the first books written after the Holocaust. It's collecting the halachic decisions that came out of the experiences of a particular man who was young, obviously. He just passed away a few years ago. His name was Ephraim Oshri. He was in Mount Sinai Hospital and passed away right after Rosh Hashanah a few years ago. Bikur Cholim actually had a discussive long shofar for him. He collected questions that people had asked him. Obviously, he had no way of recording them in the camps. He wasn't like, you know, however he tried to remember and get other people to remember, and he after the war he codified all these. And one of the questions was from a man who asked him about saving his son. Everybody needs to be saved every day. Death is all around us at every moment. It was towards the very end of the war. And, you know, every day they knew that they were getting new shipments of Hungarian Jews. So we can't keep so many people here. We have to just, you know, get rid of whoever's here. Right? If they can't work, we'll get, you know. So his son was one of 400 boys who was put on it. You know, they know where they go. So they were already incarcerated. And they know that in a few hours we're being taken to disappear. So this man's son was in the group, and he had someone in the camp who had some influence that he knew before that he felt he could bribe. And however, it doesn't tell us in the Chupa how this man got any possession into the camp itself. You were stripped and everything was taken from you. So you had any gold teeth you might have even had. But he apparently knew where there was something of some value to one of this men who could get his son off the detail. So he asks him, and he even writes in the Chuva, it was the second day of Rosh Hashanah, where he asks me this question. And does he have permission to take his son off the detail? And Rav Ashi refused to answer. He said, I can't tell you to do it, but I can't tell you not to do it. Right? So the man decided from that he shouldn't do it. And his son died. The man survived the war. Okay, if you don't get on the detail, you can be on the next day's detail. You can be on. Someone doesn't like the way you're walking by him, and they'll shoot you right there in the spot. So, you know. But he said, "I'm not going to do this by having someone else make up the number 400. They have to have their number 400. If I take my son off, someone else's son is going to be put on, who might have survived." Right? So he decided not to do it. He said, "On the second day of Rosh Hashanah, we read about the Akedah. I gave up my son the same way Amram did." Right. So here is the essential point that comes out of here is it sounds like a Gemara in the Sefer Bava Kamma. It says, "Kivon shenitan rishus lamashkes ligof." Once the destroyer is out there, "Eino mafkin bein tzadik l'rasha." It doesn't differentiate between the tzadik and the rasha. "Umaskil b'tzadik." Adarav, the tzadik is going to fall first, because forget about Russia. No, who would ask such a question? If I can get my son off, I'm getting him off. That's why Rav Ashi didn't tell him not to do it. Right? But under the clear rubric of the halachic process, the halach is you're not allowed to take him off. So why didn't Rav Ashi tell him that? He says, because here in the camp, I'm not going to teach you I'm not going to sit you down and say that you have to learn, you have to follow the rule in Siman Tav Chav Hei and in Mokosh and Mishpat, where these laws appear. Right? Which is like life thought ethics. How do you see who you choose to save over one person over another? Right? So that's not the place for that. You have to let your feelings go with true, the halakha straight, and we're sitting here comfortably, a lot of you had breakfast already, no one's dying and no one's thirsty and no one's hungry. And you can sit down and say with a clear mind, yes, the halakha is you're not allowed to take your son off such a detail. Right? Okay, that's to the interpretations we're giving. Has ki lo lahazkir b'shem Hashem, right? Targum reads like he says people say salek, means step aside. Arei havo kayomin lo havo matzlam b'shma d'Hashem. People are not being saved by mentioning the name of God. In other words, the destroyer is here. Don't think that you're going to be saved because you say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Right? I mean, this Perek Vav of Amos is such a... I mean, you guys are probably too... Certainly your parents are not survivors. Your parents were probably born after the war. Right? Sure, you guys are younger than my kids. But your grandparents might have survived. Maybe in fifth grade you had to make a project of recording some of their experiences, right? They do that in old schools. Right, so they probably told you these amazing stories that, goodness, that person should have been dead in a second. Right? I'll share two very quick ones because it fits right with this with Amos Perek Vav. is my brother's wife's mother just passed away. She was in Auschwitz for quite a long time, and she's walking to her work detail, and one of the women guards see that there's a rash on her arm. She takes down the number on her arm, and the next morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, at roll call, the guard on the gate calls out that number. Right? She looks at the number and says, it's not her number. It's one off. I don't remember the exact number. She said it was, instead of a 5, she said a 3. But she was there with her 2 sisters. One sister had the 3, one sister had the 4, and she had 5. Right? And they all pretty much looked alike. I knew both of them. They both got gonorrhea, she's the last one. And they looked, all 3 of them looked alike. As I knew, much older, of course. So she sees that her number, they called out someone else's number. She mistakenly wrote 3 instead of 5, right? So you don't get out, but that's not your number. They'll shoot you there right on the spot, right? So she's worried that now my sister is going to have to go out. What are they going to do to her? So the sister walks out. She says, it's my number. What do you want from me? So someone walks over, looks at her arm. She says, no, she's better. Get back in the room. While she had the rash all over her arm, putting it back like that, right? She still had the rash, right? They kill you for anything. Right? So, because that person wrote down the wrong number, all these descendants of hers, my brother's whole family, and everyone, all the grandchildren, had many great grandchildren. Why? Because the person wrote down the wrong number. If she writes 5, she's out there, the rash is shit right there on the spot. And so yeah, some people, maybe she said Shema Yisrael, but okay, the wrong number was already written. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did answer some, but and there's nothing wrong with that person saying, God, you answered me. But be careful, because then does that mean that God didn't answer all the others? I can't say there's anything wrong with someone I know in my shul, who was in the World Trade Center after the first one was hit, and everyone was saying, go down in the elevators. If anyone went down the elevator, they didn't make it. He said, start walking down now. Right? I think what it was is he was in the other building, the one that wasn't hit first. And everyone was being told, stay here, it was an accident, don't go down, you're going to be in trouble. If you go down, the debris is going to fall and hit you in the head, stay in this building. That's what everyone was doing. He said, no, I'm getting out of here. Right? He starts walking down from the 105th floor. Anyone who was over the floor where the plane hit did not make it out. Right? Some people jumped out the windows, but they did not make it out. So he thinks that God was with me. God convinced, but look, you have to be careful with your philosophies. God was with him, but wasn't with all of his colleagues and other people. What does that mean? Right? So just be careful what you think about the others. But I can't tell the person who made it out alive that you don't have the right to say God was with you. Well, we just say that to the survivor. Right? My father has I think, even a more amazing story, and 100 more like it, but this one is always the one that he used to tell these stories at the Pesach Seder. My father was lucky enough when the ghetto was established in a city called Lutz, which is northeastern Poland, is that he had work detail outside the ghetto. They sometimes honored to allow people who had work outside the ghetto. They would continue to let them. You had your papers. You showed your paper. You get out. Come back in at a certain time, right? If you're caught outside the ghetto past the time that your paper says you're supposed to be in, they shoot you on the spot. If you're caught taking anything out, they shoot you. If you're caught taking anything in, they shoot you. All right, but you can imagine someone who had the right to get out of the ghetto, they would try at any turn to put something in there, in a cuff, put something up their arm, put something in the most crazy places, just to get a little fuel, a stick into something, a match, a piece of food, something back into the ghetto. They didn't check you all the time, but they did spot checks. And you knew, it's not like, if you're not here today, you're getting a 0. No, if you any infraction, shoot you on the spot. Everyone's dying if you're being killed every day. So my father was bringing some small tomatoes in the front of his boots, right? And this other kid had certain slats. This is 1942, so my father is already 19, right? I know he's still doing okay. So they checked the guy. and they found so my father said they killed him for small little toothpicks that they would use for fuel. Right? And he saw me, you know, blood spilling. So my father is they said they start to check him. His boots were not on him, his boots were strapped over his shoulders, and he had something, you know, the boots went on top of whatever he had on his feet. So the tomatoes were stuck by the toe, you know, pushed in by the toe on his shoulder. So they check him, they frisk him, they say, okay, he's gone, let him go. And then the guy at the desk say, wait, we didn't check those boots that are around his shoulder. Let's look in the boots. He said, that's it, lights out. She said, look, don't say, you know, what do you hope for? You run, they'll shoot you, of course. Right? That's it. He said, I have 10 seconds to live, 15 seconds to live. As soon as he sees the tomatoes, I'm dead. What saved him, obviously something saved him, I'm here to tell you this, is that when the guy started to put his hand and look in the boots, they smelled so awful that he said, oh, filthy Jew, get away from me. He cursed him. He threw the boots at him. Threw it back at him without choosing to look at it. Now, it's not because he didn't think a Jew would put the tomatoes in such a smelly boot. No, Jews were putting food in much worse places than that. But he just didn't want to look at it that day. He didn't want to bother himself to put his hand in something that was so disgusting. And luckily they were tight at the toes that they didn't fall out when he threw it out. Right? And, you know, the leaven didn't make it way back in. Crazy. Right? And how he survived when the leather was liquidated is also crazy. Right? So all this is what almost Perek Vav is about. Okay. Now I will admit there are frukim like this in Yirmiyahu. There are frukim like this in Habakkuk itself. But there's really the Perek like this in Yirmiyahu is chapter 8 and chapter 16, where he describes Mamish children, corpses thrown out in the street by their parents because they have no place to bury them. And they're lying there decomposing in the sun. Now, other than Amos and Yirmiyahu, that's you know, you see, it's bad as it gets. Right? Okay. Pasuk Gedalof. Ki hinei Hashem mitzaveh v'hikoh habayis hagadol resisim v'habayis hakaton b'kihim. God is going to make his command, and he will smite the large houses into resisim. Resisim are small bits. You ever say on his mirrors, resise laila. Look out the window and you'll see what resisim are.
Snow.
What?
Snow?
Resisim are small raindrops. But really small. That's a good example of what resisim are. Tiny little things that fall from the sky. Right? So but in the Torah in the it's a pasuk. It's rain, but that could be. Resisim means I'm going to break the houses into such small bits. What could do that to a house?
An earthquake.
Exactly. Right. Basically, resisim and bikiyim is what we would say in English would be rubble. Okay. Maybe if you looked at the front page of any paper in the last few days, and what Aleppo looks like, that's resisim. Right. Or Dresden, or anything, or any other picture of that you may have in your mind. Okay. Okay, so the next few psukim in Perek Vav just describe why God is doing this to them, because they have brought this upon themselves. Okay. That there's no justice, there's nothing, there's lawlessness in the land. Okay. So in Pasuk Aleph, it's Rav Yosef Kara who explains that this is what caused the breakup of houses. Remember earlier in the Sefer he spoke about the winter homes and the summer homes will fall together. Right? Okay. Turn to Perek Zayin. And you're almost, what almost does here in chapter 7 is to make reference to four maraot, four visions. One is Yotzer Govai, which is a horrible plague of locusts, which is a relatively natural, common thing in Israel. They spread over the whole Middle East. They can start in Saudi Arabia, they can go to Egypt, but they, as you know from events of the Torah. The next one is of fire. The next one is of a plumb line or a wall that's being measured. And the next one is a basket of summer fruit. Okay, this is not unique to Amos. Lots of prophets do these things, especially Yechezkel. Yirmiyahu does it too. Yirmiyahu walks around the street carrying two baskets of figs, and the people say, what are you doing? What does this represent? And he gives them a prophecy about the figs. Right? Yirmiyahu gives a prophecy about a club, like Aaron's staff, sprouting almonds. Gives a prophecy about a large cauldron with a spout that's facing the north of Israel. And it's either bubbling over or the fire is starting to enlarge under it. So the prophet does something. The one who does this more than any is really Yechezkel. Right? Yechezkel's wife passes away, and he does a series of bizarre activities to indicate that he doesn't care that she died, and that he's not mourning for her. And people would say, Yechezkel, why are you doing, why are you behaving this way? And he responds. There is a debate amongst the commentaries whether the prophet actually did these things, or even these four visions here are simply a vision that was in his head when he was sleeping, and then he wakes up and writes about it. It's not, you know, I'm just telling you that in general, Rashi and his school, Rabbi Yosef Kara, Ojansi, and the French commentaries, Marie de Trani, and that framework, they usually take these literally. Hosea actually did marry a harlot. But you remember this from the beginning of the semester, right? Okay. Ibn Ezra, Radak, the Rambam and Mor Nevuchim, to be sure, and Bravanel usually, were of the opinion that these prophecies are not necessarily things in reality, but they're things in the vision of the prophet's head, and then he writes about it, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that, right? Okay. What these four are four destructive forces. One involves destruction of locusts, fire, captivity, a wall that's going to enclose you, and the summer fruit, kayitz, it's in the word kates. Kayitz is the end of the year, right? That's why it's called kayitz. It cuts is the year, cuts it. End of the year, right? Okay, this is a good raya, by the way, that we call the summer kayitz, that the year begins at Rosh Hashanah. Show me a pasuk that shows that the year begins in Rosh Hashanah. It's called Chodesh HaShvi'i, right? There is a good pasuk. The Torah describes Sukkot, it calls it Tkufas Hashanah. Tkufas Hashanah means I just made a hekev of the year. I just made a kapos of the year. The year is over now, and the new year is starting. Other than that, I would think the year starts in Nisan. Right? And you can even tell me a psak halacha that proves that the world was created in Nisan. Even though on Rosh Hashanah we say Heyom Harat Olam, there's a halacha that shows that the world was created in Nisan. Any more time what that is? Yes, exactly. Birkas Hachama. You say a blessing every 28 years. You probably might remember one when you were little. It was a good Erev Pesach about maybe 7, 8, 9 years ago. Right? It's only done every 28 years, so if you're not 28, you certainly have not done it more than once. Okay? My father has done it 5 times because there was one right after he was born. He remembers it. Done it 5 times already. It's done in the spring. And the Gemara in Brachas, at the end of Brachas, says that it is done when, forget about how the Gemara knew to recognize this, it's certainly off by Shmuel's reckoning of how to determine this, but that's not important. What the Gemara says is that it recognizes where the sun is in the sky with relation to the earth at the same place it was at the moment of creation. Why this happens only once every 28 years has to do with, and here's where Shmuel's reckoning is a little off, because he says we're well aware that there are 6 extra hours in the year beyond 365 days. Those 6 hours need 28 years to get back to a Wednesday, see it? 6 times 28 is the amount of hours in a week. Get it back to the sun, to a Wednesday, because it was created on a Wednesday. I'm not going to get into all the intricacies of this, but take it if you can. And that is done in the springtime. All right. So almost refers to these summer fruits as kayets, because the end is upon you. Get it? Kayets, cates. The summer fruit is a reminder, a clue of kayets, that the end is drawing near. Now, the end of the northern tribes. Lotov Sikkum. Now, the first two, though, the locusts and the fire, almost successfully wards off God over what they're supposed to do. God says, I'm going to send locusts to wipe out the land. Amos says, God, please don't do this. Yaakov, he calls the nation Yaakov, is too weak to sustain a plague of locusts. Send it away. Blow a wind so that the locusts move away to Saudi Arabia or to another country and save Israel. Hashem says, I've heard you, Amos, the locusts will not come. Got it? By the way, there is a prophet, in addition to Amos, his name is Yoel, who speaks about the beginning of the book, first chapters, and then he ends with this, is about a devastating plague of locusts. That means that Yoel was before Amos. Because if Amos tells us in his book that I successfully got God to ward off a devastating plague of locusts, right? What's Yoel doing saying, I'm going to bring locusts, right? So either Yoel was before Amos, you understand why, right? Because in Yoel it says this was the worst plague of locusts ever to come to Israel. Apparently even worse than what was in Egypt. In Egypt was only Egypt, this is Israel, right? Because in Egypt it says there will never be another plague of locusts as bad as this one. So how is Yoel 1,000 years later saying this is the worst plague of locusts ever? It's in two different places. Right? However, there's an answer to both these questions as follows. Abravanel and some other commentaries say that the locusts of Yoel are also figurative. They don't refer to locusts at all. They refer to Babel, Persia, Greece, and Rome. The four different types of locusts represent four different types of nations. Right? Okay. So, alright, but in Amos, I don't see any reason to explain these locusts in anything but its pshat. God was threatening a devastating plague of locusts, and Amos says, God, on top of everything else, on top of burning bodies, you want locusts too? And Hashem says, okay, Amos, I've heard you. I'll send them away. And God says there'll be a devastating fire, and Amos uses the same template. He says, God, please don't do this to Yaakov. He's too small, he's too weak. He cannot sustain. You've punished them enough already. Okay? Okay, and then comes the Chomat Anach, the captivity, and then the Kuv Kayetz, the basket of fruit that it spells the end. Okay, in the middle of that, and now I tell you before this class ends, make sure to read the article from Louis Rabinowitz. It's called, the book is called From Out of the Depths. It's just the Haftorah of Parshas Kedoshim, where he brilliantly weaves in his recent arrival to South Africa from England, right? He brilliantly weaves in his recent arrival as if though he is Amos talking to the Jewish community of South Africa, which at that time was becoming increasingly secular, right? I'm sorry to say, although many Jews were part of the anti-apartheid movement, right? No doubt. But many Jews were not, and took advantage of their status. Right? Yeah, I wouldn't call it what was going on in South Africa in 1946 slavery, but pretty close, right? The apartheid was... Look, in America it was bad too in 1946, right? Only probably World War II that allowed them to think, hey, maybe we should have integration in baseball too. You know, they just fought a war for us, and now we're not letting them play in sports. on top. Right? And the teams that integrated were the better teams for it. Right? Someone should make a study. The American League purposely did not integrate as much as the National League. And for that reason, they lost like 19 out of 20 All-Star games in a row. Go look it up. Seriously. Go look at who's playing. It was really the whole 60s and 70s until the American League, got out of that. You know, the Yankees were in it too. The Yankees had Willie Mays ready to sign. They said, we don't want blacks on the team. Right. So Louis Rabinowitz is looking at the awful treatment of blacks in South Africa at the time, and makes his argument an almost argument, where he becomes almost. Really, it's just 2 pages. It's such an easy read. Back to back, just one side, 2 sides. It's amazing. Just read through. Don't skim. Read through the whole thing. It's in your chaveret. And by the way, this I don't know if it's attributed as much as it should be, but if you listen to some of Martin Luther King's brilliant speeches on the Mall in Washington D.C., he is freely quoting from Amos. He doesn't say in the Amos, the prophet said, probably said Amos, I think. But he did. Right? So a little bit from Hosea too, but mostly Amos. It's really just let me see if you could print up. And you'll see that he's quoting Amos. Right? In this section here. So I leave you with the following. In the middle of those 4 visions, after the second one, right? A high priest, for goodness sakes, what kind of high priest is there in the north? The whole idea of a Kohen Gadol in the north is rogue, right? Your temple is rogue. These are high priests in shrines that have golden calves, for goodness sakes, right? But the high priest, his name is Amatziah. Amatziah is the name of one of the kings of Israel, of Yehuda, for goodness sakes. Amatziah, nice, strong Semitic from name, Amatziah, strength of God. And he says to Amos, silence! You're speaking against a great kingdom, Mikdash Melech, the Ir Melucha. We get that in what we say in Lachadodi, comes from where he speaks about. You're speaking against a beautiful, great nation. How can you dare speak about our destruction? Right? So he says, stop your prophecy. That's what we're going to continue next time, with the threat upon Amos' life for these 4 visions. All right? Look up, you see the 4 visions, it says on Perek Zion. Masse Amatzia, okay? And I ask the question, why does Amos tell his occupation? They tell, don't give prophecy! Get out of here! We're speaking about the fall of a great nation! And Amos says, I'm not a prophet! I'm not the son of a prophet! And then he tells him his job. Why did he care about what his occupation was? Talk about that next class, Mr. Shem. All right, guys. Have a good show.